Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Weekend, and I hope it was safe for you and for everybody else in the state, and that everybody took the precautions to physically distance and to wear masks and so forth. In short, we've had 3 weeks now of going in the wrong direction with respect to the numbers that we're seeing on cases and hospitalizations. And the numbers that we're going to talk about today don't reflect, obviously, whatever might have happened this weekend. And the reason I mentioned this past weekend, the 4th of July, is we definitely know now that Memorial Day really was a point in time at which our numbers stopped getting better and then started getting worse. I pray and I hope that that does not happen with activity surrounding the 4th of July. We have lost all the gains made in June and are now seeing some numbers that rival our peak back in April. Today, we're reporting 1,891 new cases. That's on 18,139 tests. So the positivity on those tests is just slightly over 10%. 95% of the cases that we're talking about today are community spread. Only 5% represent spread or cases that come from a congregate setting. We are also, and unfortunately, reporting 20 additional deaths today for a total of 3,231. We did see a very slight dip in hospitalizations today, but I think it was only three. But we are very concerned about the numbers that we see. And also, we're concerned because of conversations that we're having with hospital CEOs and medical directors, and I'll talk more about that in just a moment. But the total number of people hospitalized today across the state with COVID-19, 1,022. The last time we were over 1,000 was on May the 19th. And our hospitalizations have almost doubled since June the 13th, just to sort of illustrate what's going on here. The recent case growth continues to reflect that a majority of cases are now young people, and in fact, 35 to 40% over the last several days have been individuals below the age of 39, I believe it is. Yeah. The difference today and what we were seeing 2.5 months ago is that 2.5 months ago, we had numbers that were really high, but they were driven by a hotspot in the New Orleans metropolitan area. So it was basically Orleans and Jefferson Parish, and it did expand out beyond that into St. Tammany and Plaquemine, St. Bernard, into the river parishes and so forth. But it was one region of the state that was fueling really rapid growth and high numbers, and the rest of the state didn't really see that to that extent. But now we're seeing more even growth in cases and hospitalizations across the entire state. And so from that perspective, Louisiana now looks more like other states and what they're currently experiencing, including our neighbors over in Texas. So we have a statewide epidemic. It's no longer one region or two regions out of the nine that are really driving our case growth and our hospitalizations. With cases increasing, we've also seen increased demand for testing across the state. And the Department of Health is aware that some testing sites have been very slow in getting results to the people who were tested. You may recall that there was a time when there was a international and national shortage of test collection kits, swabs, viral transport mediums, so forth. There was really a limiting factor in being able to test at the numbers that we wanted to. Today, the limiting factor appears to be the availability of reagent in the commercial labs. And because reagent isn't in the commercial labs in the amount necessary, those labs can't process timely and report back the results of the tests that they're receiving. And that's something that I know that they are working on. I know that it can be very frustrating to test thinking you're going to get the results back in a couple of days, and sometimes it's 7, 10 days, and I've even heard of cases that were taking longer than that. So we're all concerned about the delays, because quite frankly, if someone's been in contact with someone who is COVID positive, they really want an answer. The other reason that I'm concerned is those individuals could be positive, may be asymptomatic, and they're not taking the proper precautions by quarantining to make sure that they're not unnecessarily exposing others. So we all have a common interest in getting these tests performed and the results back just as soon as possible. It is critical for anyone who's been exposed to someone who's tested positive to the virus to self-quarantine for 14 days while you wait for your test results. And I want everybody to listen to this, and I'm going to ask Dr. B to address more about this later when he speaks. But if you have been in contact with someone, close contact, who is COVID positive, even if you test negative, you need to quarantine for that full 14-day period, because that disease, you might have contracted it, but you don't yet have a viral load that's necessary to test positive, but it doesn't mean that you aren't positive and so forth. So the 14 days continues to be critically important. In the midst of all of this, I am pleased to share some good news with respect to testing, and that is that yesterday the HHS supported surge testing in Baton Rouge that I announced last week got up and running. It was short-lived yesterday because of the horrendous weather that came through this area. But HHS, and working with Dr. Birx and the White House Coronavirus Task Force, picked three cities in the United States of America for this surge testing: McAllen, Texas, I believe it's Jacksonville, Florida, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana. That should tell everybody in the state of Louisiana all that you need to know about whether we have a serious situation and whether it's getting worse. We do, and it is. But we appreciate the fact that we're going to have this additional testing where the goal is to test 5,000 people a day above at these sites. There are four of them, and this is testing above the baseline so that we get a better idea of just how many cases we have, particularly in the Baton Rouge area. And you don't have to be a resident of Baton Rouge. You can live in a nearby parish. You know, if you're in West Baton Rouge, Livingston, Ascension, whatever, if you want to come in and be tested, you can. You can be tested if you're symptomatic, and you should be. You can be tested if you've been in contact with someone who has COVID-19, and you should be tested. But you can also be tested at these surge sites just if you have some concern that you may have COVID, even if you are not symptomatic. The goal is to test 5,000 people a day across the four sites. Those four sites are at LSU, Alex Box Stadium. They're at Southern University at the Clark Activity Center. We have a site at the Cortana Mall, and the fourth site is at Lamar Dixon and Gonzales. More information can be obtained by calling 211. The testing will run through July the 18th, so this is not a long-term commitment. This is a hotspot surge testing effort. You can pre-register. We do recommend it. It is not absolutely necessary. But to pre-register, you can go to doineedacovid19test.com. doineedacovid19test.com. This morning, I had a very good call, Secretary Phillips and I, with about 20 hospital CEOs and medical directors from all across the state, every region of the state, to get an update directly from the field. Obviously, LDH has these calls every day, but I wanted to hear directly from the hospitals as to what they're seeing. I do appreciate the Hospital Association for helping us to facilitate the discussion today and being a strong partner throughout the crisis. Nearly every CEO and medical director on the call reported sustained increases in COVID-19 hospitalizations. And as I mentioned, we've completely lost the gains that we've made over the past couple of months. And all of this has happened just in the last 3 weeks or so. And that's very concerning to me because there are some people out there who I think continue to believe that the state of Louisiana continues to do better. And that is not the case. It's not the case in most states around the country. And I don't know what the last count is, but I know within a couple days ago, I was looking at something that said upwards of 40 states actually have increasing cases. And most of those states also have increasing positivity as well. And we certainly have both of those. We do have some regions that are actually above the hospitalization numbers that they ever saw in March or April. And particularly in Lafayette right now, the two largest hospitals in Lafayette each have more COVID-19 inpatients than they had at the height of the earlier surge in cases and hospitalizations. Now, there is a little bit of good news, and I say that you kind of have to strain to pick out good news right now. But the patients that they are seeing, on average, a little younger. The illnesses, on average, are not quite as acute. And the stays in the hospital are not quite as long. And a smaller percentage of these individuals are in ICU beds or on ventilators. So those things are relatively good if you cherry pick that out from what we know was happening previously. But there are challenges. One of those has to do with access to remdesivir, which is an approved therapeutic treatment for seriously ill inpatient COVID-19 victims. And we had a couple of hospitals tell us that they're out. But based on current caseload and what they've seen coming into the hospital recently, they're concerned about not having adequate supplies of remdesivir. So we're working on that as quickly as we can. And I would remind people that hospital capacity is not just an issue as it relates to COVID-19, because while we're in this public health emergency, this pandemic, that doesn't mean that fewer people are going to have strokes and heart attacks and motor vehicle accidents and those sorts of things. The biggest challenges that we heard from the healthcare community this morning center around staffing, keeping adequate supplies of therapeutic treatment like remdesivir, and then, of course, the testing issue that we already talked about. One hospital CEO told me this morning that the staffing issues are exacerbated by the fact that the community spread is so pronounced that more of the nurses and other staff members at the hospital are actually out because they too are positive. So that's another indicator just how pronounced the community spread is and how detrimental it is to our overall efforts. We are also hearing, and this is somewhat anecdotal at this point, but it was echoed by the vast majority of regions that we spoke to today. We're seeing a slight change in the demographics of the patients that they have admitted over the past several weeks with COVID-19. They skew a little whiter now and more male than was the case previously. And again, as I mentioned, the average age is down, so that on average the patients are younger than they were before. We all know that there's been a huge push in the African American community to highlight the problem related to COVID-19 and to promote the mitigation measures like masking and other facial coverings, like social distancing and washing hands and staying home when you're sick and so forth. And it appears now, at least anecdotally, that the patient mix at our hospitals looks more like our state demographics as a whole. And I appreciate all of the hard work that everyone has done, especially the medical community. And I appreciated the time that these hospital CEOs and medical directors put forth this morning in order to speak to us and give us their best information. But I want to reiterate that we all have a role to play, and it's going to take all of us being focused on the task at hand, and particularly complying with the mitigation measures that are in place. We simply have to wear a mask. When we're outside of our homes and we're interacting with people in closer than 6 feet, people who are not part of our immediate household, whether indoors or outdoors, we need to wear a mask. Everything that we in this country and around the world have learned about the disease and the way that it spread indicate that mask usage is incredibly important to cut down the rate of infections. I am also pleased to announce that the Department of Health is sharing an additional breakdown of COVID data by race, cases by parish. This will be updated weekly on Wednesdays going forward. I know that the department's been working hard on this for a while, and they're going to be able to share that. And like I said, we'll be updating it weekly. And at the state level, we see a disparity of COVID-19 cases. As you can see, and these numbers don't add up to 100 or close to 100, because there are certain relatively significant percentage of tests that we get back that we don't have race data for. But the 41% of the cases are among black residents, 29% among white residents. Dr. Biu is going to come up now and speak about these disparities and some new information that we are going to share today with respect to outbreaks. And then I'll come back up afterwards and conclude my remarks and then take your questions. But Alex.
Thank you, sir. So we've continued to try to put more and more data out for the public to be able to consume. Last week, for instance, added new functionality to the dashboard that allows people to track the amount of testing that's going on by regions and the percent positivity for those tests by regions. We also now have hospital breakdowns, so those same trends that you're hearing the governor talk about with hospitalizations, you can now go through our dashboard and look at your specific region and see what's going on with hospitalizations in that area. And you'll also see what's going on with ventilator use. As the governor noted, what's sort of different between this rise in cases that we're seeing and a rise in cases that we saw early on is that now we have a lot more data on the ground. We have a lot more infrastructure to give us information. And so we can see a lot more, and we've been communicating to you, the public, a lot more early warning signs. And now we're seeing sort of late warning signs. We're seeing those rises in hospitalizations that are following the case rises that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. And we haven't yet seen real big rises in ventilator usage like our neighbors in Texas or other states are seeing. But we fear that if these trends continue, we'll begin to see those curves go up. But I do want to draw your attention to that dashboard at ldh.la.gov/coronavirus. And if you keep tabbing through, you will see that we've added new functionality, drop-down menus that now allow you to go down to the regional level. So along those lines, this week what we've been able to add is more individual information at the parish level and at the regional level about race data for cases. We were one of the first states to be able to put out race data for the death data for the number of individuals dying from COVID. But now we've been able to, we think, reach an adequate amount of reliable information that we felt comfortable putting out the same data for cases. I'll note that even though we feel more comfortable with the amount of data that we have, there's still that blue wedge of 19% of cases that we do not have reliable race data for. Some of that's because we're not able to contact people through contact tracing. We just aren't able to make that connection. And a significant proportion of it is that we're still not getting the total information that we need from tests, which is our basic source of information. But we do think it's important for the state to be able to look at case data and death data because there can be disparities in both. There could be, for instance, proportional representation of cases amongst African American and white communities, and the death data be skewed, which would make us very concerned about what's going on with care for those individuals when they get ill or perhaps they're having more severe illness. In this case, we don't see that. What we see is that there's still a disproportionate number of African Americans who are actually contracting COVID compared to the white population. Again, for baseline, the African American population is about a third of the state, or a little over that, at 33%, whereas the white population is about two-thirds. And here at the state level, what you're seeing is 41% of cases are African American, 29% white. We could assume maybe that wedge of about 20% probably has a similar breakdown. So still disproportionate number of cases in communities of color. We know that that's also true for our Latinx communities. And then we see that disparity that we've been showing now on the dashboard for weeks also manifest at the death level or for individuals who are dying, sorry. One point that I will make is that disparity is starting to narrow, at least for deaths. And so for those of you who are tracking along week on week, that is heartening information. And to the governor's point, we believe at least part of that is because we've seen a lot of positive messaging and mobilization of mitigation measures within communities of color, countering any sort of narratives early on that COVID was not something that would affect all communities. And COVID affects all communities, all socioeconomic breakdowns, and so it's important that we understand where COVID is and how to protect ourselves. So we're adding that information about race at the regional level. You can tab through and see those breakdowns, as well as at the parish level. At the regional level, we're able to get into other races beyond black and white. At the parish level, because we're dealing with such small numbers, sometimes we are having to revert to just other for races without adequate number of cases for us to feel that we could give anonymity. So in addition to who is getting COVID, we also want to talk about where COVID is spreading. And so that's the other data that we've added to the dashboard today. There's a navigation tab. If you're looking at our website on your web browser, it's on the left. If you're looking at it on your mobile phone, it's the three little hash marks that allow you to go to a menu, and you can find information about outbreak settings. We've pulled here just the top five settings of outbreaks in the state, and you can see that they are bars, industrial settings, restaurants, food processing, and then colleges or universities. And what we give is the information on the number of outbreaks that have been reported or that we've identified through contact tracing, and then the number of cases that we've been able to associate with that. One important point that I think I should make up front is that this is the information that we're actually able to get through contact tracing or actually able to get through reports. It represents likely a significant underestimation of these different settings in the overall cases. You can imagine somebody not being quite clear on where they were, not recalling how they spent their day, or really, you know, being able to recall that they were maybe at that bar. So it's really not very common for us to get that kind of information in a robust fashion. So the fact that we have some of these settings, for instance, bars, so prominently being found through contact tracing and reporting, certainly represents something of concern for us. Again, we wanted to share that with the public so that you can see what we're learning through contact tracing, so that you may also think twice as you're going out and about what kind of settings you're in. And again, as we've said from the beginning, if you go into any setting, whether it's on this list or not, and you feel that people are congregating, people aren't wearing masks, or for whatever reason, the setting is not safe from a COVID standpoint, by all means, we want you to walk out of that setting and protect yourself and protect your family. Because that's what's most important for all of us, and that's what's gonna allow us to keep as many settings as possible in our economy open. So that data will be updated every week on Wednesday when we refresh weekly data. And the same for the race data across parish, region, and for cases and for deaths. And happy to take any questions while I'm up here. Yeah, so that's a great point. So the governor did reference the need to quarantine for 14 days, and this is an area of information that we see a lot of people having some concerns with. as we're doing contact tracing, as we're reaching out to individuals and saying, you may have been exposed, you know, somebody who has COVID has informed us that they were within 6 feet of you for 15 minutes. We know that some people's initial urge is to immediately go out and get tested. More often than not, by the time we're reaching you, it's been several days since your exposure, so getting tested is not unreasonable. If you know that you've been exposed today, it's not a good idea to get a test today. Because more often than not, you are not going to have any test prove positive, even though you may have indeed been infected and you'll come back with a positive test several days down the road. But for most people who are informed, they may feel like, I want to go get tested. And we're not dissuading people from getting tested. One point that I want to make, though, is quarantine, self-quarantine is for 14 days. Regardless of if you get tested 5 days after your exposure and it's negative. Because you could still turn positive at day 13, at day 14. So even if you're tested, that may give you peace of mind, and certainly you're not trying to dissuade people from getting that testing. But I want to emphasize that quarantining is for 14 days, and that number doesn't change, regardless of your test. You need to take whatever measures you can to isolate yourself in your home from other household members to reduce the likelihood that you would transfer COVID to them. And certainly not going out is a key part of quarantining for that full 14-day period. Yeah, please.
On the outbreak data, what does it say to you guys that colleges and universities are in like the top five when they've been closed to students for most of the pandemic, and yet we're still seeing outbreaks there? What does that say to you about, you know, the prospect of reopening colleges and universities and other schools in the fall?
So there's a couple of data points that we have around that. One is what the governor shared, that for the last week or so, more than a third of cases that we've been seeing on a daily basis have usually been in individuals between the ages of, say, 18 and 29, certainly 29 or less. And so that's often the same individuals who we're going to see around college campuses. There's also faculty and staff, but you know, it's the age group where we're seeing a fair bit of engagement, a fair bit of transmission of COVID going on. The other point that I make is that even though universities aren't open, they still remain centers within our communities where they reside, where people are coming, maybe doing work over the summer, and again, that age group is going to be congregating there. So a university draws large numbers of people, and so it's not too surprising then that we would see that that area or that those settings would show up. I would note that it's three that we've identified in 84 cases compared to, say, 36 bars and 393 cases. Again, tip of the iceberg, but still worth noting. We've been doing a lot of work to try to understand, by engaging college-aged individuals, what are the messages that you're receiving on coronavirus? What is your perception of your risk? What is your perception of mitigation steps that we can take? And we're trying to then understand how to make sure that our messaging is clear to inform people on the best ways to keep themselves safe. People may be thinking of their own risk and knowing that very few people in that age group are needing hospitalization. Even fewer are dying. But what I would say is, if you take a rare event and you make the number of people who are experiencing that event increase, that rare event becomes less rare, meaning the number of individuals who are getting hospitalized in that age group, in college age group, if the number of individuals infected goes up, the number of hospitalized will go up. Though rare, the number of individuals in that age group who die as a result of COVID will go up. But moreover, what's concerning to me is that we're now seeing a lot of the virus circulating across the state be in that age group, and that presents a risk to everybody else who's in a higher risk group. The governor, in a meeting this morning, pointed out if we look at the dashboard and look at a recovery number, we're now saying there's about 46,000 folks that we've estimated have recovered, but we've hit 70,000 cases. That means we now have 25,000 active cases statewide that are circulating virus in the community. And even if most of those are individuals who are in a low-risk group for bad outcomes from COVID, what that means is that anywhere anybody else goes, there is a higher chance of being exposed to COVID, whether I'm going to a bar, a restaurant, a gym, whatever. If there's 25,000 cases circulating out there that we know of, the likelihood of any of those settings being less safe is higher. And so it's really important that we all take our steps to try to drive cases down to make it safer for us to be out and about, regardless of our age group. Please. So we definitely see, obviously, most cases are coming back from population centers, but from the beginning, we've seen cases in rural areas. Some of that's, you know, that there's congregate settings in some of those areas, but also the penetration of the message, isolation, masking, the perceived risk, we think, is often less in some of those settings. So if you look at the map, you'll see every parish has cases. And we've been working hard to get testing into every parish, and as we've done that, we've seen a tremendous increase in the number of cases in some of those smaller parishes as well. So it's a significant concern. Some of our small parishes rank amongst the highest for rates of COVID cases and deaths in the nation. So it's a problem, as the governor said, that is truly statewide. This is not a New Orleans problem. This is not even a Baton Rouge problem. We have COVID rising, COVID cases rising and spreading everywhere across the state in a way that we did not in March. There's a question. So we track cases wherever they come from. We want to find out, where are those cases? Are they in individuals who are residing in those settings, or are they staff that are associated with those settings? And we do that across a variety of settings that we then lump together in these higher categories. So yes, certainly we do. For instance, we recently partnered with the CDC to do some comprehensive testing at a prison in the north. We work very closely with the Department of Corrections on their testing plans and supporting their testing efforts, and the same at the parish level as well, working with parish jails to help them build their plans for testing and help support their testing. Well, it wouldn't necessarily get reported out to the public if it didn't present a risk to the public's health. So with all of these settings, I think a distinction to make is whether we identify an individual location or not often has to do with whether we think that there is a public health risk. So if we take the example of some of these industrial settings, where we know the people who are exposed and we can manage that and make sure that they're safe and manage the people who might be at risk because of that outbreak, there's not necessarily a risk to the public. If we take the example of the bars in Baton Rouge several weeks ago, where we thought we were not able to identify everybody who would have been at those bars, we did actually release public information because we wanted to tell general members of the public, if you've been at those bars during that weekend, you need to go ahead and quarantine. You need to assume that you've been exposed. So the difference is whether it's a contained population where we can manage the exposure risk, or if it's a non-contained setting where we think that there's a public health risk. Well, so nursing homes were reporting because the federal government has mandated that reporting. So we're giving that information that the federal government has mandated.
So we're not getting information about prisons or jails because it's not mandated by the feds?
It's not mandated by the feds that be reported. So, I mean, I think we always look at how can we make any setting safer. We've been looking a lot more recently at how can we increase enforcement, how can we increase having folks in these settings, making sure that staff, that patrons are doing everything in their power to improve or to reduce the risk of being in these settings. I think bars present a particularly difficult challenge because when you go into a bar, you're often going to be seated relatively close to the people that you're around. May not be necessarily your household that you come in with. If there's music playing on a jukebox, no live music, you'll probably be leaning in closer to hear each other speak, maybe yelling over sounds. And most importantly, if you're slowly drinking a drink, you're probably not taking on and putting off a mask. You're probably not having a mask on. So I think that's a setting that presents a lot of challenges for us to manage. But what we are doing is going and visiting those sites, visiting restaurants, state fire marshal, ATC, and our own Office of Public Health Sanitarians, and looking for people who are not observing the existing restrictions. And then certainly if we find that people are observing those restrictions and we still have problems, I think we would need to revisit that.
Any actual enforcement action against bars?
So I believe that there were violations found with a small proportion of the places that were visited, say, over the weekend. I don't have all of that data. I'm not sure that any citations or anything rose to the level of citations. And usually that's because when a violation is found, at least on the sanitarian side, people are given the opportunity to correct that violation, and then a follow-up visit is done. And if the violation has been corrected at the follow-up visit, there's usually not a citation given at that point. So not at this time. Not at this time, because it doesn't sort of fall on every region. But I think the point that I made at the very beginning about just because a number's not up here doesn't mean that it's not present. Certainly, I think when you talk about sort of college and universities, those are pretty easy to identify regionally. But I would say any one of these settings, you should assume that it could be going on in your neighborhood. What's more important is that you, when you're a patron going into those settings, observe whether you think that people are following restrictions or regulations or not. So at this time, we're not planning on breaking that up by region, but in the future we could consider it. Again, we always want to make sure that we have adequate numbers to provide cover or adequate anonymity for these organizations, because this happens because people are willing to share information with us, and where people think that their business is at risk of being shut down, we often don't get the information that we need, which is ultimately how do we reach people to make sure they're safe, they're isolating, and they're reducing the risk of spread in their communities. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Biu. As you can see, with the known outbreaks that we have been able to pinpoint, a majority are associated with bars. When you look at the number of cases, it's food processing settings that dominate those numbers. And that's likely because those individuals work in very close proximity to one another, and then oftentimes they also live in close proximity to one another as well. So I think no matter how you slice and dice the numbers, to put it bluntly, COVID-19 is probably more present, more rampant in Louisiana today than it has ever been. And we need the people of Louisiana to again step up, pay attention, and do their part. If you go back to the dashboard for just a second, please. One number that I didn't highlight for you is that number 5. So in per capita cases, early on, we were as high as number 2 in the country. As things got better in Louisiana and somewhat worse in other states, we actually were number 10 in per capita cases. Today, we went to number 5. So this is another indication that we're not going in the right direction. And again, these are known cases. These are cases that we can identify because of a test result. Somewhere around a third of all individuals who get COVID-19 are going to be asymptomatic, and the vast majority of those will not test. And so there's a lot more active cases than just those that have been identified through testing. And if you back out those that are recovered, you can see we have more known COVID in Louisiana today than we've had at any point up to now. Another number that I think I forgot to give you, and this will tell you how hard we're working in partnership with hospitals and local government and the National Guard and GOSEP, the Department of Health, our federal partners, some retail outlets. We're just in the 8th day of July, and we have reported 137,226 tests already. So you know that for the monthly testing goal, and it is a minimum goal, but it was a minimum goal that exceeded the requirement set forth by the White House Coronavirus Task Force, was for 200,000 tests in a month. We're at 137,000 tests in the first 8 days of this month. So we're working hard to know what's going on in Louisiana and to get in front of it. So before I take questions, one more time. People, everybody in Louisiana, you have a role to play. Please do your part. Please be a good neighbor. Let's take care of one another by wearing our masks. Remember, when you wear masks, you're not protecting yourself so much as you're protecting others from you. And when they wear a mask, they're showing the same courtesy that you are. And so it's important that you do that. It's important that you wear that mask anytime you're outside of your home and that you're interacting with people who are not part of your immediate household. You should always stay 6 feet away from other individuals who are not part of your immediate household. You should stay home when you're sick, and you should certainly wash your hands with soap and water frequently. The next press conference will be next week. I don't have a set date yet. My radio show is next Wednesday afternoon, so we'll let you know when that's going to be. Our team will advise you. So with that, I'll take questions, Sam.
Yeah. Like we are. Texas has limited, I think they've ratcheted down on restrictions, they've limited gathering sizes, which is the statewide mask mandate. Are you discussing or considering whether to do a statewide mask mandate and limit gathering sizes further than 250?
The answer is we discuss everything. I am not currently contemplating a statewide mask mandate. I believe we are now up to four that I know of local mandates, those being in Orleans Parish, Jefferson Parish, Baton Rouge, East Baton Rouge Parish, I should say, and in Shreveport. And those are the biggest population centers in the state of Louisiana. And what we're trying very hard to do is to promote compliance with the mitigation measures and doing so in a way that is insofar as possible, fully consistent with the White House Coronavirus Task Force plans and guidance, I should say. And that guidance is directed with respect to mask mandates to local government, not state government, in those areas where you have increasing cases and increasing positivity, which is why I support the mask mandates that have been put into place. But whether we have a mandate or not, we can't be clearer in the messaging that we have been communicating to the people of Louisiana literally for months now about the need to comply with these mitigation measures. You know, if you're interested in making sure that as much of our economy can stay open as possible, that more people get back to work, customers get back in stores and restaurants and so forth, you have an interest in wearing a mask, because what's going to affect that more than anything else is the case count. Anything that reduces the case count, flattens the curve, reduces hospitalizations, ultimately is going to be very, very helpful. We know that a central part of this, probably the single most important thing that people can do, is to wear a mask. So we are really urging that. And, you know, obviously with respect to the venue size or gathering, I should say, we're taking a look at that too. I happen to think that right now we may be a little bit more liberal with that than even the federal guidance that we've been getting. So we are going to take a look at that as well. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Maybe even indoor dining. I know 2 weeks ago you said you were focused on better compliance with the current restrictions. Seeing the surge in the past 2 weeks, has anything changed your mind to that lightening of maybe what Dr. Burks has been referencing?
Well, I will tell you that we are obviously getting that guidance directly from the Coronavirus Task Force as well. We did more than 3,100 site visits over the last 10 days or so, and I don't remember the exact time period, primarily working through the Office of Public Health, primarily working through the Fire Marshal's Office, but assisted by the Office of Public Health and other entities as well. We are trying to gain more compliance with existing restrictions. We are having success in that. In almost every case, when we find violations, they are corrected on the spot. Now, we are going to start our follow-up visits, and if they're repeat violations, then you're going to see some actions taken there. But at the present, for example, with respect to the 50% occupancy for on-premises dining at a restaurant, it's hard for me to keep up with what other states are doing, but I think that's where Texas is now. And so it reaffirms to me that our decision that we made a few weeks ago not to proceed into phase three was the right decision. I can only imagine what would be the case today had we loosened restrictions further. And of course, we didn't move to phase three because we didn't meet any of the three gating criteria in order to do so. So we're paying attention to all of these things, and we may be making some adjustments on the restrictions. But right now, we still remain focused on getting more compliance with existing restrictions and with existing mitigation measures. But if this proves to be insufficient in getting our numbers back under control, we will do whatever is necessary to make sure that we don't lose the capacity in our hospitals to deliver life-saving care. I mean, we're just not going to get to that point. And we're nowhere near that today, but clearly we're on a trajectory that if at some point we don't flatten that curve again, we will get there. And so we're trying to balance all of this and make the most prudent decisions that we can. Yes, ma'am. Well, first of all, I would hope that at least aspirationally, we all would want to see our schools back open 5 days a week for in-person instruction. I think that's critically important for a number of reasons. But at the same time, like everything else we do, we have to balance that interest with the interest of preserving and protecting the health of students and staff and faculty and looking at whatever the situation happens to be at any given time in the school year, and particularly just in advance of when that school year would commence. You're going to see the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, for example, promulgate some emergency rules here very soon. You've already seen guidance that's flowing from the Department of Education to the school districts. And you're going to see school districts implementing even more measures aimed at promoting the safety of students and staff and faculty and so forth. Under no circumstance, and while I know the president talked about trying to see education delivered the way it was pre-COVID, we are in a new normal. And even if we have in-person instruction going on our campuses, it's not going to look like it did before COVID. Because you're not likely to see school assemblies, you're not likely to see students eating in the lunchroom. You're gonna see students who are not going to be coming into contact with individuals who are not part of their immediate cohorts, and all these sorts of things that really need to be done in order to get our students back on our campuses, which is important for their education certainly, but also for nutrition. It's important for social and emotional wellness. The vast majority of students with special needs, including mental health issues, get those services through their schools. So we want to make sure, and we have to remember that teachers and school counselors are mandatory reporters with respect to instances where they believe a kid has been subject to abuse or neglect. And so for all of these reasons, we want our kids back on our campuses, but we need to do it safely. And that's what our goal is. It was just recently that CDC issued a plethora of guidance, and I can tell you that guidance has been received by folks in higher education, K-12 education. They're pouring through that now to make sure that it's incorporated into our plans for reopening. And so our goal is to reopen. Of course, our goal was to never to close schools to in-person but instruction. And we're going to do everything that we can to open our schools, but to do so safely, and it's impossible to know on July the 8th exactly what that's going to look like or whether it's going to be possible. What's the situation going to be a month from now? Yes, sir.
Yeah. It's announcing they're not going to have any fall sports. We have Senator Fields, request of Betsy. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think for me it's a little too early. It's kind of a follow-up to what I was just saying in response to Melinda's question. I don't think on July 8th we know exactly what this is going to look like. And so I appreciate the concerns that Senator Fields expressed. And I think we all have some concern that the situation may be such that's a prudent decision. But I don't think we're at that point in time where that decision needs to be made. And I think we need to know a little bit more and get a little deeper into the calendar before that decision is made. Yes, sir.
State Representative Danny McCarthy released that video saying, they couldn't make you wear a mask. They can stick a needle in your arm against your will. He also compared non-mask wearers to the Jews in Nazi Germany. What is your response to that?
You know, it's utter nonsense and it's sad. My guidance, my best advice to anyone who wants to talk about any person or any situation today and analogize back to Nazi Germany or to the Holocaust is just don't do it. It never works. It's never appropriate. And it's certainly isn't appropriate in this circumstance. When mask wearing is recommended across the world now, including by our own federal government, the White House Coronavirus Task Force, the CDC, others, to stop the spread of a disease that is highly contagious and that is highly lethal. And so I just think it just misses the boat on all fronts to compare that with something related to the Holocaust. I mean, just it's nonsense and it's sad. And hopefully people will avoid that in the future. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so Dr. Burks called me last week, and she and Admiral Brett Girard, who is at the U.S. Public Health Service, they were looking at certain hotspots across the country where you had increases in cases and increases in positivity. That were very pronounced, and they wanted to assist in going into those areas with additional testing with the hopes of identifying people who had the coronavirus, getting them into quarantine and so forth, and try to cool off some of these hotspots. As I mentioned, they picked three of them across the country, McAllen, Texas, Jacksonville, Florida, and Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Part of the conversation that I had with Dr. Burks is in Baton Rouge, we may be seeing this because of that younger demographic. This is obviously a college town with LSU and Southern and BRCC and so forth. We don't really know exactly why we were seeing it, but I will tell you, we appreciate the help. We really do hope to get to 5,000 additional tests per day between now and July the 18th, and I'm encouraging people to take advantage of this opportunity that we have. This is the only federally sponsored testing that's taking place in Louisiana presently. We did have early on, as you remember, some testing sites in Jefferson Parish and Orleans Parish. But in terms of federally sponsored testing, this is it. And they're sponsoring it, but in partnership with Baton Rouge City Government, GOSEP, and the National Guard, and the Office of Public Health, they're all making this testing happen. It is important, and so I'm asking people to call 211 if you've got questions about this testing and how you can take advantage of it. Again, you can go to, do I need to get a test? Do I need to get a COVID-19 test.com to pre-register if you want to do that. And those sites, again, are at the Cortana Mall, they're at Lamar Dixon, they're at Alex Box Stadium at LSU, and the Clark Activity Center on Southern's campus. So I think that's going to conclude our press conference today. Again, we will have another press conference next week. I don't know exactly when that's going to take place, but we will let you all know, and I look forward to seeing you there. You don't have to wait till next week to get information, because the dashboard is updated every day with the exception of Saturday. And so you can go there for additional information. Thank you all very much. And I again implore the people of Louisiana to do everything that we can to comply with the existing restrictions and mitigation measures.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.